This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
The current time here at WRFL is 6:21, and you were tuned in here with us all the way to the left. My name is Grant.
And I am Mitch, and we are here thanking you for tuning in and teching out with us this wonderful Thursday evening as we take you through some of the new tech news that has come around this past week and maybe a little bit past behind there. I don't know. So with that, we've been listening to some tunes. What have we been listening to up till now, Grant?
So right before this break, it was Leave It Alone by Broken Bells. And back before that, it was Imminence Grease by Little People off their album We Are But Hunks of Wood. And back before that, it was off the album In Return, Memories That You Call by Odesia. So keep it locked. We're going to swing in here and hit up some technology.
You almost sent us into a music break just then, didn't you?
I did.
So, I believe you said you had a thing ready for us to go on and speak about. So let's go on and get that pulled up and, you know, get talking about tech.
Yeah. All right. So one of the big pieces of news this week is that Twitter is changing in a very fundamental way. Twitter is doubling its character count for languages that it calls condensed. So that's pretty much everything but Japanese, Chinese, and I believe the third is English.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Or not English, but Japanese, Chinese, and Korean. So all other languages besides those will now be climbing from 140 to 280 characters.
Which I almost think that is a mistake. Because the 140 characters has really been a unique trademark, is the word I'm looking for, of Twitter. At this point, I feel like with 280 characters that you're getting closer to Facebook territory, which Twitter does not do well. Twitter is good about short posts, like you said, that fit in 140 characters. It really forced us, especially when it comes to journalism, you know, people who do news via Twitter, they have to get a catchy enough tagline and summary within that 140 characters to get someone to read that article. I feel like it's Twitter's 140 characters has really helped us become more concise, to the point, and descriptive within a smaller amount of space than we had been previously. I mean, think about it. How many times have you been in like a writing course or something where you have to give like a synopsis, a brief synopsis, and someone says, you know, give me a synopsis that fits in a tweet, go, or something like that. I mean, even if it's verbally spoken, it's meant to convey, hey, give me a very short, sweet, to the point, you know, synopsis of what's going on, what we're doing, and how it needs to be done. So I really feel that by doing this, Twitter might hurt themselves because then they're just entering territory that's already been pioneered or already well under the control of other social media such as Facebook.
Yeah, I that's not a way I've heard it worded in discussions I've had with this. For me, I'm kind of, I guess if anything, I'm kind of okay with the jump up to 240 because I always found myself incredibly restricted by the 140 character limit. And something that goes along with this is the reason why they didn't expand Japanese, Chinese, and the Korean language.
Is there are more formal languages you have to, you can't really condense, you know, the Japanese language in the way it's written without losing some of the context of what you're writing.
Well, the average American English tweet is, on average, about 40 characters, and the average Japanese language tweet is about 15 characters, because the characters themselves...
You're right. I'm sorry. You're right.
more meaning. Yeah, a character in and of itself is closer to a syllable or even a whole word.
Yeah, that's, I'm sorry. That's why I was confused. In that sense, yeah, because if they increased it to 280, I mean, that's basically a paragraph in Japanese.
That's whole paragraphs, yeah. Yeah. And so I think that despite the initial reaction to this, I think we're going to see that this is overall a good thing. So on, again, comparing English to Japanese, on the English side, about 9% of all tweets that are written in English have exactly 140 characters, which means that someone pruned and worked on their sentence to get it to fit in that exact space, right?
Which is what we were talking about as far as people having to condense their vernacular down into a way that still makes sense but is concise and to the point.
So 0.4% of tweets in the Japanese language hit that 140 character limit,
mm-hmm.
which, again, I think proves that 140 does work really well, and that I think what it is the threshold for what someone wants to say in a discrete amount in general is just slightly beyond that 140, which I think is why people had fun with the constraint of that. And that way, I think it was kind of a precursor emotionally to Vine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the constraint of 6 seconds that Vine gave you was something that made it unique. And I think in the same way, that's what launched
I just always
Twitter.
Found Vine also to be a very, sort of a very, like a blip in social media. Because it was only around for what, maybe 2 years, if that?
I don't remember when it actually started. But yeah, as far as when it was popular, it maybe had only a couple of years.
It died last year, right?
Yeah.
No, I remember looking at Vines my freshman year in 2013. So it had been around actually for about 6-7 years, now that I think about it. I still find the social implications of Vine to have been very strange, because there are now several stars, social media stars, that got their fame through Vine. I mean, it's kind of comical. You know, they just made a bunch of these 6-second videos and got insanely popular at the very beginning, and then started, you know, things like the Streamies, which are the social media / internet media award ceremony, similar to the Emmys or the Tonys or the Oscars. It's all based around more or less YouTubers and, at the time, Viners, whenever they were still a thing. And it just instantly exploded their popularity. I mean, there was, for example, one girl who became famous for dancing on Vine, and she ended up on Dancing with the Stars, you know, as I think one of the stars, if you will, and then one of the contestants got paired with her. And it's just fascinating to me to think that a video platform that was around for like 4 years have propelled some people into such wealth and fame. It's kind of astonishing.
Yeah, certainly. And
well, even game video game streamers too. The advent of Twitch, you know, that's another, albeit much more niche social media platform. That was one that really wasn't around until about the same time as Vine, right?
Yeah, actually, even a little bit later, I think.
It became much more widespread later.
Yeah.
But there's people who make money on that. I mean, and obviously they're YouTubers as well. And it's just kind of crazy to me to think that people can just make videos or whatnot, and that's how they make their living. I would love for us to make a living off this podcast, but but no, we won't. Anyways, so yeah, I always find the social implications of these types of things to be very interesting.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to think what changes might come about to the platform as a whole. I know that in general, Twitter has become a lot more media-focused and a lot more news-focused, and so I'm interested to see...
Well, tweet decks. I mean, even our own journalism students here use a form of a tweet deck to do the morning news.
And what is a tweet deck? It's not.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It's basically a condensed form of your Twitter feed that is all strictly news that you can be getting live updates of. Okay, this news just hit on this outlet. Let's pick up the story, write our own version of it, and post it on our version faster than any competitors can, for example. Things like that.
Kind of a super modern Associated Press in a sense.
Yes, that it.
See,
I'm not as familiar with TweetDeX. I know what to call it, but I know what it looks like, but I don't know how one uses it or how it works. So, yeah, that's a good description for it. Modern day, super fast Associated Press.
Yeah. And so, again, is this a pivot? Is this 280 character change a pivot for news?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's going to encourage them to write longer again. But I feel that we, as a society, have gotten used to Twitter being 140 characters and trying, especially when it comes to news, trying to get whatever tagline or whatever catch into that 140 characters. That's something that we can just glance at and instantly catch our attention or not. I feel that going to 280 will lengthen that writing back out, and you'll start seeing maybe a decrease in some articles because people think, oh, well, now I have more room to describe this in, and it loses people's interest before they get to the part that maybe would catch their attention if it were only in 140 characters. I would be curious to see some actual stats on that at some point once this has been in place for about a year or so to see what kind of change there had been in journalistic writing within 140 to 280 characters, as odd and absurd as that is to say.
Yeah, because previously it was basically a little bit longer than the headline that you could fit, and now you can get something much closer to a paragraph in.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I said I think that it's going to be a problem for them. Because look at Facebook. When you see news articles on Facebook, you see the title, and maybe you'll see two or three sentences at the top of a Facebook post before it gets to the news article link itself. I'm just afraid that if Twitter starts to going even longer than, say, those Facebook posts, because you could probably fit, you know, three or four short sentences in 280 characters, maybe even up to five. Once you get up to that higher number, you know, you're going to start losing the interest of some people on the internet, which is a horrible thing to have to say, that, you know, we 280 characters might not be able to hold our interest anymore. But I just, that's how I see things. You know, once people have gotten used to, well, you get the point across that catches my interest in 140. Why do I need the extra 140? Just use it to catch my attention on a different post.
Fair enough.
So, I don't know. That's the way I view it. What have you?
All right. Well, good chat about Twitter. We're going to take a break for a minute and come back.
That's right. But before we come back, maybe something that you didn't know.
If you're hearing this, that means podcast advertising works. WRFL is now accepting new applications for advertising in a selection of our original podcast series. If you or someone you know owns a business in Central Kentucky and would be interested in advertising on WRFL's original podcasts, please email development@wrfl.fm.
Good evening, Lexington. Thank you for tuning in and teching out with us here on Tech Talks. We are about to come back for another talking break. We're going to be discussing some fun things we've got lined up for you. And just to sort of give you a preview of, preview of what we have lined up, we're going to be talking a little bit about video games, specifically a little incident that happened with a video game that I actually enjoy and have been playing recently, and what happened with it in recent news that is kind of interesting that a lot of people have wanted to see happen in the form of a cross-compatibility thing where PlayStation users and Xbox users were playing on the same servers, which a lot of people want, but has been sort of a fantasy in the industry for a while for actually being feasible or happening. So we have a little bit of info on that that's kind of interesting to talk about. After that, we have Microsoft has, you know, as we've been talking about recently, the advent of quantum computing is upon us, and it will be soon. And Microsoft has actually already written a computing language for quantum computing, a programming language for quantum computing. So we'll be discussing that a little bit later on. And then our final article probably that we'll talk about tonight, bar any small articles that might come up in between these, our third and final big article for the night is going to be that researchers have recorded a fourth set of gravitational waves. So that's a story that we've been keeping track of here for a while now. The existence of gravitational waves, first of all, was originally not thought to be possible. And then at, I want to say CERN, and we can double check that before we talk about it more, they were able to reproduce and show gravitational waves being able to move an inanimate object in vacuum, thereby proving that gravitational waves were a viable form of propulsion. And so they've recorded a fourth set. They now have four data sets on gravitational waves, which is more than we have ever had before. So all of that and more is coming at you soon. I believe we are going to go on and start talking about that first article I was telling you about. Is that correct with you, L. Grant?
Works for me.
All right. So to sort of start us off, we have there's this game called Fortnite, and it's a pretty fun game. I enjoy it a lot. The premise is it's a sort of tower defense zombie survival game. So what you do, you can actively build, and it's an open world concept. You can actively build within the map you're on. Well, I shouldn't say open world. There is set space limits within these maps, but you can build anywhere within that map that you are concerned about. And the whole point is you find the objective, you fortify the objective by building defenses with resources that you've gathered in game, and then you actively defend those defenses by killing zombies as they come and try to tear your walls down and eat the objective, if you will. So this game is really robust, really fun, and it is hosted ironically, or not ironically, but a little bit surprisingly, on Amazon Web Services servers, which is weird to think of a video game being hosted on something that you can go and personally get a server for and host a personal website, for example. So about 2 weeks ago, Fortnite pushed an update and they had gotten a configuration setting wrong, and suddenly PlayStation users noticed some different usernames coming up in game that didn't match the format of PlayStation Network usernames, being that they had spaces or that they had, you know, special characters like underscores, things like that, that were outside of the PlayStation Network parameters for usernames. And then in checking with some, you know, some friends who might have both systems, they found that they were actually playing on the same servers and that PlayStation users were in the same games as Xbox users, which has been a thing that every single, or I wouldn't say every single person, but 90% of all video gamers who play on consoles have wanted for some time now. Recently, Microsoft has come out in support of it, saying that we would support going full cross-compatibility, and that's what the argument, the debate is called. It's called the cross-compatibility debate. The big holdout has been PlayStation. They've been wanting to keep their servers sort of exclusive for whatever reason. And so it's very, you know, a lot of people just thought that this wasn't possible, that it would be too hard to code the video games to be able to play with both sets of player bases, And this game, which is, would be considered an indie game, has blown that theory out of the water by proving that both PlayStation users and Xbox users can play on the same servers, even though they're on different consoles.
So there exists some data that lives on its server that is compatible with both systems.
It's the way they built the game.
Yeah, the way they built the game allows for that interaction.
Which a lot of people thought that that just was not an easy thing to do, that, you know, it definitely wasn't something indie games could do, that it was something that even the big game studios like Microsoft's 343 studios couldn't do as of right now. And that's kind of disproved that myth, that literally the only thing keeping us from cross-compatibility is just PlayStation wanting to keep everything exclusive.
And what are PlayStation's reasons for doing this beyond the are there security concerns
I'm not sure on those kinds of specifics. I think if anything it's more that PlayStation is known for having a lot of PlayStation exclusive libraries or on their PlayStation exclusive games in their game library. For example, Destiny came out originally as a Destiny exclusive, and then maybe 2 months after it came out on PlayStation, it came out on Xbox and other platforms. And sort of ever since then, Destiny, as an example, has, you know, the PlayStation users of Destiny have definitely gotten some favoritism over, say, Xbox users when it comes to the video game. They got different special events, they got some extra special weapons that came up that if you played on an Xbox, you couldn't get a hold of, things like that. And so, I don't know, it's things like that. I think it's more just a purely arbitrary issue than a actual factual issue to prove some alliteration right there. I don't know, have you found anything obvious yet in your Googlingo?
Well, apparently both Rocket League and Minecraft are supposed to be all platforms by the end of the year,
mm-hmm.
cross-compatible.
Which has been an announcement, and I think that they finally caved just on those two games due to the immense popularity of them. But by and large, most games, like, say, Call of Duty, are kept separate, and a lot of gamers don't like that.
Yeah, and so one of the interesting features that comes out of this is that when Nintendo agreed to both a port of and immediately the cross-compatibility of Rocket League, it largely undermined PlayStation's
reasons for not.
And especially in regards to Rocket League, yeah. And they still argue that there are some security concerns that they have, but I think that's really about the only thing that remains in the way of mm-hmm. them moving forward with that plan.
Mm-hmm. So, for those of you out there that have always thought that it's been a pipe dream, it's finally confirmed that it's not. We have hard evidence of Xbox users and PlayStation users playing on the same servers, not intentionally, but by pure accident. So, with that, I think we can move on to our next topic, which is kind of an interesting topic. It's also Microsoft-related, but I'm not sure how I feel about it. The next topic is, as we said, quantum computing is on its way. It's going to be here eventually. It's going to happen. It's interesting because Microsoft has come out saying that they have written a programming language for quantum computing, which, you know, you may be thinking, well, is that the chicken before the egg or the egg before the chicken? How's that work, that you can write programs that'll work on a quantum computer if there's no quantum computer to try the programs on? And it's a very valid concern. It's a valid question. Microsoft doesn't seem that concerned about it, but it's one of those things that you're like, well, I don't know if, I mean, why it wouldn't work. It works on my computer now. So, I mean, it's going to be, how to phrase this also. So for those of you out there that are confused about what quantum computing is basically a form of computing which takes advantage of the fact that a single object can be, at its core level, both a one and a zero at the same time. So the way our current computers work is everything's black and white, cut and dry. It is a one or it is a zero. That is how all of our current electronics work. So quantum computing basically lets an object be a one and a zero at the same time. And by doing that, when they apply different operations to that variable or that object, what have you, what ends up happening is it allows you to condense the amount of times it takes for computations. Because, for example, if you're doing a computation on what is 2 plus 2, now you, while you're doing that one operation of what is 2 plus 2, you can simultaneously be doing what is 2 minus 2, as an example. So it's just kind of interesting to see that they've already written a programming language and how they've managed to do that without an actual quantum computer.
For example, Intel or Microsoft actually wrote the compiler for an Atari machine. I think it was the 8600 prior to the release of it. So this isn't the first time that they've done something like this. And it seems that they're simulating quantum computers and then running their code on these simulated machines in the development of it. But it's really more of a description of a... you can invent a new language even if there's nobody that speaks that language yet.
That's true. I'm just more concerned of... The main thing holding us back from quantum computing is the physical quantum computer, actually making a piece of hardware that will execute things the way we expect it to on the quantum level. So we can simulate those in our current, even albeit supercomputers at this point, just in order to get the amount of processing power it would need to operate that simulation. I'm just saying that it's one of those things like we can have all these software, all these simulations that work in our simulated world, but then what happens if we build a quantum computer and then it doesn't work that way? I mean, all that's going to have to go right out the window unless they're able to either fix it or adapt the language to match the reality of quantum computing and its physical limitations. Because, for example, our computing, the only reason that our computers can be slow... the only reason that our computers can be slow is because sometimes our calculations are limited by the speed of light. They can only move so fast. That's a physical constraint. So quantum computing is supposed to alleviate a lot of those physical constraints with traditional computing by allowing things to exist in what's called multiple states, that one or zero, where it's being both a one and a zero at the same time. It has multiple states, as opposed to if it was in a current computer, it would have a state of a one or a state of a zero. They could never be both at the same time. If they were, that would more than likely be a physical short circuit. So yeah, Microsoft has already made the computing language for quantum computers. They don't exist yet, but we think they are on the way soon, we hope.
Should hope so.
Yeah.
I'm actually still trying to wrap my mind around the ways in which these machines get applied, because they have some pretty specific uses. You know, it's they're not all purpose everyday machines.
Yeah. So even if quantum computing did come here, you probably wouldn't see your phone or your tablet or your local laptop or desktop or gaming PC. They probably wouldn't be quantum computers. At least not for a long time. Mainly because they will probably be very expensive. And also they're probably going to be so powerful that we only need to use them as a replacement for supercomputers in order to do large, complex calculations that on a normal supercomputer might take a year, could, say, take 6 months on a quantum computer. which there are actually calculations where a computer will sit there and crunch numbers for a whole year. I mean, that's some of the simulations that these guys will feed into these big supercomputers is just astounding.
Yeah, and so I think we're going to have some challenges moving forward in finding, just figuring out how best to apply some of this, because apparently this kind of math is going to be really good for chemistry and chemical simulations.
Because the physical world, there are things that can exist in two different states at the same time. I want to say they're called colloids. Whatever it is that's both a liquid and a solid at the same time, that's an example of something having two separate, very distinct states in the same instance. And the best example of that is that cornstarch slime that you'll make in like kindergarten that you'll play with, and you'll be like, wow, it's a solid, but then you hold it between your fingers and it drips like a liquid. Cornstarch and glue, that's what I was thinking of. So yeah, it's going to be great for simulating things like that, because then we can simulate, say, you know, what's going to happen when this volatile fuel reacts with, like, say, oxygen. There may be a period of time where half of that compound is still existing in its original state, and the other half is in existing in a form where it's both its original form and an oxidized form. You know, the act of burning something, that's technically in two states at the same time, you know? So it's going to make simulating real-world events a lot easier. It's going to probably make a lot of things like, obviously, quantum physics are going to be a lot easier to simulate on a quantum computer, because things are kind of behaving the same way.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just thinking about something here, just kind of working it out in my head, but one of the big problems with weather models right now is that we can only collect information about the cloud as a whole, and that we're not able to collect a lot of good information about what's happening inside the cloud.
Which it plays a large part in the weather. I mean, especially, or like a high-pressure, low-pressure system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of that cloud may be on the boundary of a high-pressure system. The other half might be on a low-pressure system. You know, what does that do to the inner mechanics of the cloud? What does that mean for the cloud's movement? What does it mean for its likelihood to produce precipitation? I mean, all these things are things that are just so complex we can't model them on current computers.
Moreover, there's this idea of determinism, which was largely taken out of the science community because of quantum physics, and it's this, so the classic idea of determinism, which was subscribed to for a long, long time by physicists, is this idea that if I knew the current location and trajectory of every atom and every cloud in all of the Earth, then I would be able to run a simulation on a computer fast enough and simulate the weather of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And be able to predict very accurately, very distantly into the future what the weather is going to be. And unfortunately, quantum physics prevents that presumption of being able to take those accurate measurements from being true. And so perhaps it is that a quantum computer could accurately test out the models of spread into the future and better help us guess at the weather.
Yep.
So there's perhaps an example of somewhere where we might see this in our day-to-day lives that wouldn't necessarily be something that we would see around us or in our home.
That is correct. So with that, it's currently 7:31. Yeah, 7:31 in the evening here. You are tuned into Tech Talks here on WRFL Lexington, 88.1 FM on your radio stereo digital dials. However you want to listen to us here in Lexington, courtesy of the basement of Whitehall. That's right, we are located in the basement of Whitehall down here, making sure to fight off all of these dungeon demons to make sure that all this music is here for you. So with that, we're going to get back to the music for a little bit, And then we'll talk about some gravitational waves, which is another thing that this quantum computing would be a great thing to simulate, is the behavior of gravitational waves.
It's really making waves.
Wow, bad puns. That's my job. What are you doing? Seriously, what are you doing? That's my job. Anyways, with that, thanks for tuning in and checking out. We'll be back here in about 15 minutes or so. So until then, sit back, relax, and enjoy the tunes.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.